Pleasure to meet with you, George. The earlier book of yours, Revolution in Mind, is a staple of the psychoanalytic studies MA that I run at Birkbeck with my colleague Daniel Pick, who's a historian and a psychoanalyst, as you and many other people will know. And it's a really fine history of the origins of psychoanalysis that our students have been reading for years. This new book, Of Fear and Strangers, The History of Xenophobia. I mean, I was really impressed with it. I've read it twice now. I found it really accessible, really elegant, a really powerful presentation of the emergence of the concept of xenophobia, of how it's expanded from being an attribute of so-called savage societies under the colonialism of the 16th century onwards, even before it was named as such as xenophobia, and how it then became a kind of pseudo-psychological explanation of prejudice, anti-Semitism, and racism. So it's really an absorbing and provocative book, and also enviably accessibly written. As I think I said to you when we met last week, I've been trying to write accessibly like this for years and I've never managed it beyond the first sentence of anything I've ever written. So I really admire people who can do this, who can write, do scholarly work that can actually be read by all sorts of people who are not necessarily specialists in the area. Anyway, I don't think that you need to really offer much justification for writing a book about hatred of others, and particularly around racism in the world as we know it today. Especially perhaps most recently in the light of Black Lives Matters and the decolonial movement. But it's hardly news to anybody, and perhaps especially to people who come to an event at the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Antisemitism, that racism and exclusion of various kinds, antisemitism included, are rife in the world, and perhaps the most damaging demarcation lines between people who are regarded as human and having human rights and people who are regarded as not even human. So I don't think you need to do that. But what I am interested in is why you adopted the frame of xenophobia for this. And there's really two things I'd like to ask you. Firstly, just to invite you at the start to say something about what you were trying to achieve with this book, who you had in mind when writing it. What is the kind of debate that you're interrogating and intervening in? And then I think particularly why this way, particular way of addressing the discussion of fear and strangers. I mean, I'll just very briefly give a quote from the beginning of the book and then let you take over for a bit. You say right at the start, you say, in speaking of anti-Semitism, of Islamophobia or homophobia, we name the maligned group, while those who do the discriminating remain otherwise undefined, unknown in and of themselves. Xenophobia corrects that imbalance and directs our attention to the source of the trouble, thereby opening up a critical line of inquiry. So on the face of it, this seems really persuasive. You know, we want to know who's doing the hating and why, and stop talking about the victims as being somehow implying somehow they're the source of the problem. And I think many of us would buy that completely. But the argument against it, I guess, would be, is there a danger that you might lose the specificity of different kinds of racism, different kinds of prejudice? Does it run together, anti-Semitism and anti-Black racism and Islamophobia and so on, in a way which, under this general term xenophobia, where we should be keeping these things together? So I'm sorry that was a bit long-winded, but firstly, just who is this book for? What are you trying to achieve? And secondly, can you sort of explain, perhaps even somewhat defend this approach to thinking about the what we might call the perpetrator rather than the victim?
Well, first of all, let me thank the Birkbeck Institute. I'm really honored and delighted to be here. So I thank you to David Feldman. Thank you to Daniel Pick, who recommended this. Thank you, Stephen, for participating. I always admired speakers from your nation who would come over to the United States and speak in full paragraphs. And I see now that I've gotten a four-part question as my opening question, why they need to be ready for such things. So I will try to take up the many interesting things that you said. Look, I wandered into the subject because I had prior interests that in some way all seemed to collide in 2016 when xenophobia was very much on a lot of people's minds. I was not ahead of the curve. I was interested in the other mind problem, which is, you know, can be a very highfalutin, complex, abstract problem about can one mind know another? It was maybe something that came out of my last book, which was on the emergence of the mind as a natural entity. And it's very abstract, more so than I could actually grasp. But I'm interested in the question. And as a psychiatrist, I'm interested in that question in a pragmatic way every day. So that was part of it. You know, the other part was the, you know, I was in, I tell in the beginning of the book, I was in London promoting Soul Machine, met with all my friends, and they told me Brexit would never happen. I overheard the conversations about Turks invading London. And I told my friends, don't worry, Donald Trump's never going to get elected. He got elected on a slew of xenophobic kinds of claims, anything he threw that he, at the question of American bias that stuck, he would use. And xenophobia seemed to be a term that encompassed a great deal. So I wandered into this in that way. And then the third leg of my interest, of course, is as I'm a son of immigrants. My parents are Lebanese Americans. And my grandfather actually came to the United States, returned to Lebanon, got stuck. And then my father and mother came many years later. He got stuck during World War I. So it turned out that the story I was telling in many ways mirrored my family's story, since it turns out xenophobia is not a term from antiquity, but was first coined in the 1880s and does kind of have this arc that follows essentially much of my family's story. Why xenophobia? Well, you know, I didn't see the advantages immediately, but I saw that there was a set of questions that were different. I was not an expert on anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or any of those things. But as a historian of psychiatry, I'm kind of an expert on phobias. And this was a phobia. It seemed like maybe it was a little bit in that terrain. I wasn't sure. Turned out that was actually mostly a red herring. I knew about stranger anxiety in children. I knew the naturalizing arguments that said that this was something that was inborn. I was pretty skeptical about that, but I knew about them. And I didn't think anyone else was weaving that into the story. So I came into it, you know, often as one does in a book project, in a misbegotten kind of half-hearted, half, you know, way. And then, you know, what happened was, turned out that everything that people said about the origins of xenophobia were wrong. It wasn't from antiquity. Couldn't find it at all. And, you know, when a historian sees that, like, this is a story that's never been told, now you really get into the hunt. Of course, I know it's an important problem. It's a huge problem, maybe so huge that there's no story there. That's really the worrisome thing when you go to xenophobia. Like, if it's like, is it like a history of laughter? Has it been with us since time immemorial? How do you write, it's like Borgesian, how do you write a history of something that's, you know, always been with humankind? It's like breathing. So I was not at all sure there was a story there that a historian could take up, until I also examined the evolutionary arguments for xenophobia and saw that they were, you know, very much lacking and very much in need of correctives. And to this day, you know, this book has gotten a lot of one sentence rejoinders from people saying, but wait, isn't it just evolutionary? And the whole argument of my book is, no, it's not. You know, that competition is yes, pre-wired, but so is cooperation. Cooperation is what makes for a city like London. That's a powerful, stratified, you know, that's a, if you want to think from evolutionary point of view, that's a much more powerful force to figure out when you have to fight and when you don't. So I put all of those aside and I thought, okay, intellectual history is going to be the framework here. When did the term emerge? What was the context? What does that teach us about this term that we're using a lot? Because these terms that we're using all have contexts that are enriching in helping us understand not just what they mean, but the contradictions that are often implied and not laid out, the trouble in using these concepts. And so in a way, that was the start of the story, which, you know, immediately made it was clear, had a difference from, as you said, anti-Semitism, racism, Islamophobia, homophobia, all of those name the victim groups, I think they're all very, very important. I make it very clear. This isn't instead of, but it is alongside of. It's a different question. You know, there was a famous American philosopher in the early 20th century, Hosiah Royce, and he said, we talk about the Black peril, we talk about the Yellow peril, but what about the White peril? You know, he was trying in his maybe clumsy way to reframe the question around the people who are actually the victimizers. And the way that we use those other terms implicitly often seems to suggest that it is something about that group. So I think it's very important alongside of that to have a concept that says, these what goes on with the people who actually often don't care. It's society's minority. They'll give up some sort of scapegoat group. And, you know, whether it's Jews or Blacks or Hispanics, it depends on the historical community that you're in. But actually, there's something common, perhaps, in the haters, in the groups that hate. And what are those commonalities? Isn't that interesting and important? So that's really a long answer to how I got into it and the framework that I adopted.
But that's great. Thanks, George. And just as fluent as anybody else who might speak in paragraphs. But can I just follow that one up? Because your last point up. So I certainly see the significance and the importance, actually, of placing the responsibility for, let's for the moment call it stranger hatred or other hatred, in the people who do the hating rather than in the recipient groups of that. But again, I just want to query something here, which is both about a kind of potential for psychological reductionism, we might say, which makes hatred and which relates to the evolutionary argument that you were just giving and rejecting, which makes the fear of the other, repudiation of the other, a kind of automatic sort of fallback of a troubled mind. And then it says, okay, and then where that goes, where that hatred goes, might depend on social conditions, for example, which is a particular minority group in the society in which you happen to find yourself, which has actually been a tendency, as you point out in one part of your book, actually been part of the tendency in psychoanalysis, which in some ways has got quite a powerful theory of how we get rid of the badness inside us by projecting it onto another. But it makes it, as I say, a kind of, the danger is of making this a psychological, an inbuilt feature of the mind. And the problem with that, as I see it, is that, well, don't these types of hatred have very specific histories? For example, anti-Semitism, you know, rooted in Christian anti-Semitism, particularly in Europe. And indeed, you give a very, very interesting account of the Inquisition in relation to crypto-Jews from the 16th century onwards in the book. So anti-Semitism has that source, whereas anti-Black racism has different kinds of sources rooted in slavery and in the, again, some Christian stuff. I mean, I don't need to do the history for you. You're well versed in history and you make that clear. But my point is simply, are we missing something here about the specificity of these different histories, which maybe make the kind of hatred of these different groups actually different phenomena? Not the same thing simply being expressed differently, actually different phenomena because they have these different social and historical conditions surrounding them.
Yeah, I don't think so. If we think about it, not as an either or kind of question, but a both and. In other words, I'm trying to add something to our understanding. And if we just look at historical specificity, we never look for commonalities. To reduce to a commonality that one marches through history would also be an error. Look, the biggest example of that is, in fact, racial science. Mm. Racial science said there is an embedded primitive psychology that is categorical for primitive races. The Easterners have it. The Westerners don't. Therefore, xenophobia is explained. So I, obviously part of my story is to show the catastrophe of that way of thinking. But that does not mean that within bounds, we can't have psychological models. And what I do is historical. So I say, what are the psychological models that people created over time to try to understand what was happening in these historically specific situations? So that is not to get rid of historical specificity, but to add to it, right? And if you add to it, you say there are historical factors that make for certain qualities of the hated object, but some of the ways, and again, I would also, the troubled mind part, this is a part of normal psychology. What I say is this is the darkest corner of normal psychology. This is not for madmen. This is for human beings. And so if you have a complex model with variables that you put into a historically specific situation, you end up with a much richer explanation than if you just kind of ignore that. So, you know, the very kind of telling quote that was really important to me, I got to it late, but it ratified what I was doing. It was Frantz Fanon, who, was a Black French psychiatrist who was sent to Algeria to be a psychiatrist. And he wrote this sentence that I find really quite devastating. He said, you know what I realized? I realized that the Frenchman hates the Jew, hates the Arab, hates the Black man. And around the circle goes. And so historically specific groups need to be protected by law, that we need to be very clear about why they, and probably they in specific, need specific protection. But it does not undermine that to say, what are the commonalities here? What are the commonalities that will allow us to see the connections between, as Fanon said, the French anti-Semite, the Jew who hates the Arab who's an anti-Black racist? How do we think about that without losing track of some commonality? And that's where I think, you know, and again, it's not, it is an implicit claim that I make that we need to think psychosocially, psychohistorically, that we need to be able to have some models, which will be imperfect, but as long as we know their limits, what they can do, what they can't do, they give us some way to think about how this emerges within an individual and then a group. So that's what xenophobia is about. Xenophobia, in my view, is a three-part problem. It's a problem of identity. It's the xenos, with the Greek, the ancient Greek term for guest or stranger. It's a problem of affect and affect regulation, fear, phobia. And then the third thing is, everyone who's ever looked at this problem says it has something to do with human groups, with how individuals are part of communities and groups. So I say any kind of explanation for xenophobia has to touch on these three things. It has to say something about self and other, say something about fear and affect regulation, say something about how individuals are part of groups. And if you get those three things, you really got a pretty expansive explanation of that problem.
That's really fascinating. So, I mean, just a couple of things to come back on. One, just on Fanon very briefly. It's also interesting, though, to note that Fanon in Black Skin, White Masks devotes quite a lot of attention to differentiating anti-Semitism from anti-Black racism. He says, you know, the Black man, he uses the terminology of the 1950s, of course, is hated in his corporeality, in his body. And he sees it as a different kind of thing for the Jews. So he does hold on to both the specificity. And then, of course, he'd also ask those questions about alliance. But
the risk in that, if I might jump in, Stephen, is that you end up deploying stereotypes yourself and essentializing something about these groups. And Fanon is criticized for this, and I think rightly
absolutely
so.
Absolutely right. Yeah, and absolutely.
And so to be armed with the notion of the stereotype is to also be worried that you might deploy one if you make these kinds of essentializing claims. And I try very hard not to do that.
And yeah, I don't think you do it at all. You're very clear, actually, when you try and pick those claims apart. But the other thing I'm just interested in, where you finished, it was, I think, with a kind of psychological model, or at least the model of the individual. And yet one of the things I think you show in the first part of the book, the historical part, which, as we both already noted, is largely about the way in which notions of stranger hatred emerge before the term xenophobia is invented. That comes late, but you start the book in the 16th century, I think, with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and the conquest of South America and colonialism and the Inquisition, which, of course, nobody expects, as we know. But one thing that I think you point out there is that at its earliest stage, it seems like justification of the hatred of the other, in this case, the marking out of the Jews of Spain as being outside the boundaries of the new state as it's being formed, that this is actually a social operation, that there's a ways in which this is encouraged, that the hatred and then expulsion of the Jews is encouraged specifically in order to serve social ends, that is to form a kind of investment in the state. And it's not, I think in that, when you're doing that, it's a very, very persuasive and it's a very powerful account. And, you know, I was really impressed with it. But it sounds different from what you just said in relation to the sort of individualizing of xenophobia.
Well, it is different. And part of the kind of complexity of this book was to be able to tack from, notions of, as you say, history of nations, of large communities trying to organize themselves. And the way that hatred of others has operated in political history, to the attempt to understand it on a more microscopic level about small groups and even individuals. But just to go back for a second, you know, my argument is that as far back as we have written record, strangers have been considered dangerous and potential enemies. So that's equation has been there for a very, very long time. And then I start to show, and you can go back to the Bible and Hebrews and in the New Testament as well, that you start to see voices that pivot against this equation. And you know, that I could have tracked in a whole nother book, you know, every instance of that. But what I do is I skip forward and I say, look, let's look at this problem in modernity. And therefore, let's look at the first modern empire and nation state where this becomes actually a problem that is critical, and that is Spain. So I talk about how overnight the king and queen of Spain attempted to create the purest Christian state out of one that was the most heterogeneous. It was a place that had been under Islamic rule. There was a large Jewish community, and as we all know, the Inquisition emerged to make these claims first against the conversos, the people who were fake Christians, who were like sneaking into powerful positions, but were quietly Jews. And then, you know, that just went on for hundreds of years as a nation building operation, constantly raising fear, constantly finding, you know, once they ran out of conversos, they just went to Jews and Muslims. And so expulsion, et cetera, et cetera. Now you need to keep this focus on who the internal enemies are. And at the same time, you know, for the people who wanted to be the purest Christian state, you know, they ran into this, what I call a cosmic sized irony, when they land in the New World and they're all of these people who are clearly not Christians and have no idea what Christianity is. And so between the slaughters in the New World and the occupation and the conquest and the Inquisition, we have models for both the way nation states after crown and cross needed to organize themselves and build themselves as a community by using internal enemies, and the way imperial powers would operate abroad. You have a kind of early prototype of both the problems that are going to happen internally with internal minorities and enemies, and externally with imperialism and colonialism when we look at Spain. So that's why that was such a good example, I thought, to start with. And as you say, that's before the term xenophobia is coined, which, you know, as I was startled to find in the book, is it's kind of coined a little bit and as a very minor usage, but really goes viral in a very odd, upside down way with the Boxer Revolt in China, where first in France and then in England, this is called xenophobic. And that term then goes viral to all the colonies, to all the metropoles. Suddenly, the Spanish are talking about how the Moroccans are xenophobic, and the Italians are talking about how the Ethiopians are xenophobic, and the Americans are talking about how the Mexicans are xenophobic, and the Filipinos are xenophobic. This becomes a one-stop explanation for why colonized people are revolting. And so that is the actual origin of the term when it's adopted into encyclopedias and dictionaries. It was quite astonishing for me. I thought I was doing the history of a very high-minded ethical term, and that was the beginning. That also is, I think, instructive. We have to be careful about how we use these terms. If we hollow them out and give them little meaning and throw them around as simply pejoratives and ways to label people, we have a risk of doing that. And so that was really shocking to me, but really instructive in terms of how then a whole band of folks, and I, you know, try to honor them in a way by showing this lineage that go all the way to Lemkin, you know, with it, and his coining of the term genocide, how they start with Las Casas in Spain in the 16th century and go in a way to Lemkin, pivoting against the notion that the other people are the xenophobes, and saying this is actually a term that is an ethical one for self-reflection. Are we xenophobes? And so that's part of the kind of tradition that I try to kind of create. Who were these people? Often very brave, often, you know, on the run or in grave danger, but nonetheless, who stand for these kinds of values.
That's brilliant, George. Thank you. I'm aware we've got about 10 minutes maximum just together, and I've got two things I really want to ask you. And I'll try and ask them one at a time. But just on what you just said, this is really not asking you to talk, say it again, but just I thought your documentation of people who have resisted what we'll call xenophobia over the centuries is really fascinating and important. And it did raise lots of questions for me about where that resistance came from, how they were able to sustain it, and I suppose that does relate to my main question, which is a kind of what do we do about it kind of question. In the second to last chapter of the book, which you call Why We Hate Them, there is a little epilogue as well, you bring together various parts of your argument, and you identify what you say are four different models, paradigms, I think you call them paradigms, right, for understanding xenophobia. And just to quote you, they say models of human behavior which targeted conditioned fear responses, that's the first one, cognitive prejudice, that's the second, forms of paranoid projection, so that's what I referred to as the psychoanalytic version before, and the process of othering, which is Sartre and so on in the 20th century. And you give us you've already given us in the book, actually, before this penultimate chapter, a very full account of these models. You note that there's defects in each, and then you distinguish between three main types of stranger hatred that you've already told us about, I think just a bit earlier in our conversation. You call them other anxiety, overt xenophobia and covert xenophobia. Yeah. And you differentiate between these different things. Overt xenophobia seems in some ways really hard to contest, I think. But anyway, and then you say, to be effective, the response to xenophobia needs to encompass all these elements. Right. So here's a question. It's an obvious one. This sounds huge, right? You've got these different strands of xenophobia, some of them very severe in the sense of the overt xenophobia, for example, seems very, very resistant to challenge. Covert xenophobia even denies it's xenophobic. It just does it.
Yeah.
So what do we do? What should we be doing about xenophobia? What does it mean to address all these levels?
Well, I don't know that we have much choice. And I do think we've made progress on a number of those different fronts. So, this is not really an original kind of notion. What it is a consolidation of the critical history I've done before. And I say, these are the efforts that have been made. Instead of them living in silos, the behaviorists in one, the Foucauldians in another, we need to use them all. We can put them all together and recognize that they're not all the same kinds of things, but we can use them all to understand what kinds of things can be done to make matters better. For the behaviorist model, which is one of Well, you know what? Maybe I'll share a screen and show one graph, one thing that might actually make this. Let me go back one. So this is kind of a summary of the different models that other people came up with, right? And the first thing is, I say that other anxiety, just being uncomfortable with a person who speaks a different language, who looks different, that's human, and that we have to accept that that's human, but we have ways of working with that dialogue, mutual recognition. But what if you have the behaviorist model for a phobia, which is, you know, I show with little children, they show the white rat, they crash a cymbal behind the kid's head, and that's a traumatic misassociation that all the rats in the world and even animals are dangerous. Well, that can be used to understand some models of bigotry. There was one person who said to one of the behaviorists, you know, I was a young girl and a Chinese man chased me through the woods. Ever since then, I've hated the Chinese. Okay, well, we also know what to do about that. There is a clear model of amelioration, and that is essentially the social project of desegregation. Expose people, put them together, they will habituate, and they will realize that these generalizations that they've made from some incident or some discomfort do not hold. So that is just a support for something that we've already tried to do in society. Then the cognitive model of negative stereotypes, which, you know, we know are rife. And, you know, they might be different in different places. In the United States, we have a 400-year history of anti-Black racism. It is in our language. It is part of our culture. We have to adopt a way of being aware of that. And we know that if you, you know, have negative cognitive biases, you can learn them, you can unlearn them. That's the project that I think we've been on for many years. I'll skip down to the last one. The last one is really structural. It's institutions have ways of thinking that are commonplace, that are simply the way we do things. And they, when are exposed to light, are revealed to lead to discriminatory outcomes. The people in those institutions might not intend to be racist or anti-Semitic. They might not think of themselves at that, but it's not about individual intention. So this is where structural problems need to be unearthed and re-presented as ethical problems. The biggest problem is the problem that Adorno and the psychoanalysts talk about in terms of people who won't go to your anti-bias training, do not care to watch the movie that goes against stereotypes. Why? Because they're actively invested in having an other who is inferior to them, having an other who holds their shame, their guilt, and it stabilizes them. It stabilizes them. It gives them personal relief. They're not just going to give that up. And we know how difficult it is to help an individual gradually realize that this is a projection. In an article I recently wrote, I say it's just an elaborate form of confession, where what is white supremacy other than an elaborate form of confession about a subculture of white shame? That's what it is. How do you return it to sender? That's a problem that I think really needs a lot of work. And, you know, the very long-term solution of less authoritarianism in the family, that's what Adorno came up with. I mean, that's a really long-term solution. but we know that those are problems that we have to face. Otherwise, what are our choices? So that's a kind of summary of conclusions.
Thanks, George. Yeah, if you can unshare, that's great. Thank you. So I've got one final question, but I do want to notice that it's a very practice-oriented approach that you're taking there. And it fleshes out some of the more kind of, I suppose, the writing on ethics you might get from people who've been using Levinas or indeed even Hannah Arendt to address some of these issues. Anyway, this is my last question, and it comes right back to where you started, I think, your presentation today, which was with your Lebanese family history. And you write about this in your preface. It's a really powerful piece of writing, actually, and very, very interesting, and something which, from a psychosocial studies point of view, I'm very keen on. You describe, you know, you have this terrifying mentor who at university reads your poems and
says, he's not really terrifying. He's terrifying in quotes. He was a big bear, but he was a wonderful, wonderful mentor. Yeah, Michael Harper, the great poet.
Yeah, he says to you, Makari, where is your history? And that leads you to write this introduction. And so I think, you know, just to finish off now, I think I'd be very interested to hear. I mean, to me, you know, reading this, I think I mentioned to you last week, it connected with Michael Rothberg, who'd also spoken to the Institute for the Study of Antisemitism not long ago, his idea of implicated subjects, that somehow we are implicated in our responsibility to the work that we do, and also, of course, to the others who we represent within it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and that raises all sorts of questions about how we use our personal histories in doing academic work. But I guess the simplest question to ask you is, what difference has writing this book made to you?
Okay, well, thank you for that question. It's obviously a hard question to answer. One part of it that's very strange is I have this impression, you know, there are certain indigenous people where they don't want you to take a photograph of them because they feel like they lose something. The Hopis mm-hmm. were the ones that I knew. I feel like I've given something up that used to be very private and personal. And so there is a weird sense that I wouldn't say mourning, but of a weird sense of loss in some way to write about myself. I haven't done it much at all as a psychoanalyst. Of course, one's not supposed to. But I felt like it would be simply dishonest to write this book without showing the potential stake I have in it. And in fact, you know, one of the early chapters is. This book is kind of structured as a voyage or an attempt at discovery. And one of the early chapters is essentially a countertransference error. Like it's the Oxford English Dictionary gives a definition. And I think, okay, this is it. And there was a lot there for me to misread as anti-Syrian bias in antiquity, which turned out to be not what they were talking about at all. And so I put that in the book because, first of all, it's a wonderful story. But second of all, I wanted to say, you know, we can't write books about bias without attempting to wrestle openly with our own bias. That to shame people who have a bias is to shame all of us. We need to manage them the way analysts manage countertransference. And so I put that in the book specifically to show, okay, watch out for me here. I don't know if I got this, but I'm trying. And that's the way we need to think about, I would say, stereotypes, which are rife, which are unconscious bias, which is impossible to not have in a particular culture. So I'm glad you liked that. It was.
I do. I think it adds a whole layer of energy to the writing in the book, actually. It's one of the things that gives it its life. I mean, it's got all the scholarship, but it's that. Does it? Thanks ever so much.
The second part is, of course, I'm from. My parents are from a place which is fell into civil war and one of the most bitter kinds of other hatred kind of battles that unfortunately isn't over.
Yeah, and that's really powerful at the beginning. And then we don't have time to talk about it, but just so everybody knows, there's a beautiful short coda at the end on Walter Benjamin, which is also, I think, very moving and seems to be very personal too, even though it's not about you in quite the same way, although you're in it. So thanks ever so much. So I'm going to hand back now to David. David, I'm afraid it's been 38 minutes. Apologies.
Well, thank you both very much, Stephen, for your probing questions and George for your luminous and lucid responses. We've got some time left for questions, despite Stephen overrunning by 3 minutes. So please put your hand up in the chat as a participant, raise your hand if you have a question. I'd like to just start though by asking George, I suppose it's a question about the politics or the political response to this work of yours on xenophobia.
Yeah.
Because by posing, in a way, it goes back to the issue that Stephen raised at the beginning, though coming at it in a slightly different way. If we pose the problem that minority groups face as one of xenophobia, one frames the problem and hence to an extent the answer in universalist terms rather than in particularist terms. But many persecuted minorities are highly invested in particularist rather than universalist answers to the problems which they face. Yeah. So I suppose I'd like to ask you a question about whether that's something in your mind as you wrote this book, and about the response to the book, whether that's been part of the response.
I mean, one of the responses is, you know, great book, but he didn't give us the answer. And I mean, historians don't really do that. And I did feel some responsibility to say something about what we could do. So I stuck my neck out there. This book is a hybrid book. It has a little memoir, a lot of intellectual history, a lot of political history. And then at the end, it really does, I stick my neck out and try to say, these are some of the things we can do. And P.S., this is what's been going on since the Cold War. I argue that the new xenophobia is emerging, that we think of as emerging recently, really started at the end of the Cold War. But look, that's been one of the answers. The evolutionary answer comes back again and again. And it goes back to an earlier question that Stephen asked, and in a way, it's a fascinating question. What were the ideologies or the ways of looking at this problem that allowed some people to see it as bigotry when most others didn't? I think that's a really important question. You know, for Las Casas, it was his brand of Christianity that we're all God's children. Obviously, did not work for a lot of other Christians who were deeply invested in the Inquisition. But the other two secular answers are people who were deeply committed to liberal toleration had a kind of rudder that helped guide them through some of this, despite, you know, all of the ironies we find and exceptions that they make. Liberal toleration was one way that you came out with the answer that this is xenophobic, even when much of your culture disagreed. The other was socialist brotherhood. That the notion that there's a meta-national brotherhood allowed others to say, okay, wait, this doesn't look right. And even if I share the same unconscious biases as my brothers and sisters over here, my ideology tells me I shouldn't. So I think that those are you know, important ways into the question of how we think of not just xenophobia, which is the problem, but what are the kinds of ways as political beings that we think about the potential solutions as well. That goes to the question of not just a psychological solution, but political and social ideologies that create subcultures that aren't riddled with shame, right? That isn't just that's a psychological way of framing it. Subcultures of shame, I call it, but it's a political problem, right? When people who live in a very disparately economic society, have lost their dignity, that's a problem that's not going to be fixed at a psychological level for each individual. And I try to make that clear, for example.
Thank you. I don't see any hands raised immediately. So let me go to the chat. We have one question from Nancy Al-Hachem, who asks, how can society be psychoanalyzed out of its illness? Amy Allen tried in Critique on the Couch to bring together social critique and psychoanalysis. Do you see a way for the discipline to give practical solutions to society, which in a sense goes back to the question, okay, yeah. So George, what's the answer?
So look, you know, I think that there are a bunch of answers that are easier, but this is the tough one. And I don't think psychoanalysis has a great track record in terms of giving social solutions. I think that the basic notion of defensive projection, not the projection from antiquity, which is I'm like you, but I'm exactly everything, you're exactly everything I'm not. I dislike you because you're all the stuff inside me I cannot be. I think that's a very critical insight that then needs to be kind of used, you know, Adorno and the authoritarian personality, people tried to use it. But that insight, I think, is critical to the hardcore racist, the hardcore anti-Semite, the people who are not amenable to some sort of enlightenment project of like learning about our biases and, and learning about how we've been programmed to dislike and fear strangers. So I think that's a great insight, but psychoanalysis, and maybe, you know, the other thing is psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic psychotherapy give you an insight of what you need to do. What do you need to do with a paranoid patient, small p, not big P, who has these kinds of notions? You have to get them to open the door, to take back the projection, and then tolerate it. Tolerate their own shame, tolerate their own guilt, be supported to do that. So what's the analogy from there to a community? I mean, I wish I knew the answer, but I think that's what we need to do.
Thank you. We have a question from Theo Richardson Gould. Could you unmute yourself, Theo, and ask your question?
Sure, thank you. Thank you, David. Thanks, George, for the talk. I suppose it's actually pointing at one of the last things you mentioned, which was tolerate, which is a little bit of a problematic word. But I was just thinking about in this current paradigm, which we're in, where there is a lot of change happening, and there's also a lot of awareness concerning the fact that people live different personalities for different social environments. And in a sense, we have to go through these dimensions of acculturation. If you are from a certain social background, which doesn't fit within the mainstream, you have to acculturate yourself in order to fit within society. And I'm just considering this in the sense of who holds power and so forth, but whether we'll get to a point where there'll be a more inverse relationship with acculturation, where we lean in to actually listen to how, say, for instance, public health is understood in society from a minority perspective or from an indigenous perspective, rather than through the mainstream lens and filtering down into society for everybody to acculturate to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I would say you're asking the question about power. And so, you're also asking a question, I think is exceedingly important for pluralistic societies. How much acculturation, how much particularity, how does one, e pluribus unum, as we tend to believe in the United States, accept not, because subcultures they like each other. They like the food that the other, they like the language, that particularity is enriching. And so where do you draw the line? And I tend to draw the line with the public square. You know, I think that in the public square, I'm interested in your ideas about toleration. You know, I'm really thinking about John Locke. I'm thinking about the Christian secular sectarian warfare, and the way that we must tolerate difference in the public square, and we can go off and do whatever we want in our kitchens and with our churches and synagogues. But the public square requires a public identity that in some way allows for a public discourse that isn't utterly atomized. So I think it's a big question for political scientists, and I don't dare go much further than that, but thank you. It's a very good question.
Stephen, do you want to?
Just very, very brief, because this is George's show, but just quickly, that I think also there are issues about, it relates to both these points, actually, the one just raised and the one about psychoanalysis. The issues about vulnerability, how we react, how we respond to our own vulnerability in the face of things which feel like they're threatened to us, that are constantly arrayed. And I think there's a good deal of contemporary work on this that's of great interest. A particular favourite in our department is Judith Butler and her recent work around grievability and the ways in which responses to one's vulnerability can be violent, or they can eschew violence in order to find a kind of what she calls a force of non-violence. The other thing I wanted to just say, the notion of tolerance as a problematic notion, I think this is very, very important. And George has just acknowledged this as well, I think, if I heard that correctly. And it relates to, because if you tolerate someone, it's already saying there's something in them that could potentially be intolerable. You know, you have to tolerate them because they're different, because they're other. And that's, again, I think that's one reason why people have maybe become interested again in Arendt and the notions of hospitality hospitality is from Levinas, in Arendt, the notion of cohabitation, that we don't tolerate the other. We find ourselves having to live with the other And
I mean, that's so lovely. Yeah, I wish that were true. I actually am going to make an argument for tolerating people who are otherwise, without that ethic, intolerable. That really, for me, grasps at the harder problem. Hospitality is lovely.
Yeah, but cohabitation. No,
and mutual recognition is God. When you got it, that's, you know, that's the lottery. Tolerating people who you think are demon worshipers. That's what Locke was talking about. And he didn't do a good job of expanding it. As we know, his definition was super, super specific. Like, he didn't really think that Jews or Catholics or much less atheists were part of this story. It was really just Protestant sects that drove him crazy, but you have to tolerate them. But then gradually that ethic has grown so that, yeah, the people that you think are demon worshipers, that's who you have to tolerate.
Yeah. There's no point in, okay, yeah.
Did you want to say something, Stephen?
I was thinking about the parallel with forgiveness. It's only worth forgiving those who've done something unforgivable.
We have another question from Emily Zido or Zido.
Hi, you got my last name correct. That's wonderful. So my name's Emily. I'm calling from Philadelphia, and I work in public affairs for a government agency. And this, I've been thinking a lot during this conversation. And my question is, when I interact, the most interactions I've had with like those kind of mobilized xenophobic Americans who, you know, through the power of voting, brought Donald Trump into you know, the executive office. They're from communities, at least that I've in the South where I was going to school and where I have family ties, that are not very diverse. They're places that might have a variety of restaurants and some, you know, some intermixing of languages. But for the most part, their xenophobia is not very, it's not practiced. Like, they don't have a lot of interactions with these people, right? And so on one hand, it's not very like, it's not inclusive in that way. They're just doing things based off of assumptions. But in the other way, they also have this like deep felt maybe anxiety, or also a feeling of you're talking about shame and, you know, not having economic access or maybe not representing the great American that they think that they should be in some ways. But I guess my question is, like, you know, reconciling those two things. Do you think a xenophobic person is somebody who likes themselves, or are they fundamentally somebody who does not?
You know, so one of the things I tried to say is there are different kinds of xenophobic people, and that if you're going to say someone is a xenophobe, that's where I go to the psychoanalytic definition, because that says this is so deeply ingrained in their personality, it's fair to say they are that thing. Otherwise, I would say that many of us are prone to xenophobic bias. It's not intrinsic to our personality structure. But let me go back to your earlier statement, because it's a very important one. You know, two of the rule outs for xenophobia are economic competition argument and cultural invasion argument. So commonly people say this isn't xenophobia, it's direct economic competition, what do you expect? Or it's a cultural invasion, and anyone would protect their own culture when it's being overrun. And I take those very seriously. But what you find again and again when you do research is that, you know, if you look at the AfD in Germany, where did they emerge? They emerged like in your neighborhood, in parts of East Germany where there were no Syrians. It was a symbolic thing. They were not economically overrun. They were not culturally invaded. So, you know, I think those are reasonable caveats. We have to be fair and keep those in mind. But they're very frequently not the case. And that's what empirical research has shown. So that your area, which is homogenous, you know, would probably be altered by desegregation, exposure and habituation. Put a whole bunch of Asian Americans and African Americans and Arab Americans and Jewish Americans in that diner with those folks, have them work alongside and go to school with those folks. And you're going to, I think, find that a good number of those people will alter their views. And then there'll be the hardcore. And those hardcore, I think it's fair to say, if you really understand the way that they operate, it would be fair to say that they are xenophobic. But I'm careful to not call anyone that thing versus having xenophobic bias. having other anxiety, which is a different and much more, I think, malleable thing.
Thank you, George. We have an interesting and a different, interesting because a different sort of question in the chat from Gordon Ingle, who asks, what about own ethnicity bias in human facial recognition? We construct a template face based on those in our in-group.
Yep.
Out-group faces are less well remembered until we have experienced enough examples to alter our template. Is there any role for neurobiology in understanding xenophobia?
You know, I think let me be provocative and say to the question, no, that neurobiology right now helps us understand capabilities. And so, you know, in the book I talk about, there are really important, fascinating things that we're learning about fear and about how fear is modulated in the brain. There are fascinating things about cognition, Daniel Kahneman's work, et cetera, that fast thinking and stereotypes. So a lot of that stuff, of course, is very important to helping us understand this. But the, you know, what I'm really skeptical of is these kind of deep histories of primal man that, you know, that create a kind of notion of what has to be, and then limits our imagination and limits our capacity to actually think of counterexamples. So I think that my neurobiology friends, when they're careful, say, you know what, when we measure threat in rats, we can't discriminate between threats that are like, oh my God, that's a black person, or oh my God, that's a lion. We just look at threat. So social systems create what kinds of threats we react to. And even though there is, as you say, good literature on face recognition, that wears off very quickly over time. Put people in the right school, and by the time they're seven, they're going to be very astute at recognizing different characteristics of a minority, for instance.
And we have just what I think will have to be our last question in the chat from Carol, who asks, can levels of xenophobia be medically, psychologically diagnosed, validated, or treated? Or is the base perhaps is the best option perhaps to leave alone if there is no harm-based option to be a xenophobe?
Look, I'm trying to be very clear that this is not a psychiatric illness, that this is part of normal human psychology. It's a dark part of normal human, the same way hatred is part of normal human psychology. So I do not diagnose xenophobia. I am looking at it as a broad-based, multi-layered psychological phenomena that intersects in a historical situation, in a social milieu, and allows for some of the worst outcomes of humankind. So that's really how I'm thinking about it. And so it wouldn't be about medicating or diagnosing. It's not that medical model.
Thank you. I'm sorry to say we are out of time, but in concluding, I'd like to thank Stephen for his really sort of careful, and as I said before, probing questioning, and a questioning which is based on decades of his own thought and his own insight. I'd like to thank everyone who has come this evening, especially those who have who've asked questions either in the chat or in person. But above all, I would like to thank George for sharing his ideas and his new book with us, for discussing and setting out for us the emergence and development of the concept of xenophobia, and secondly, how it operates in the psychosocial realm, and as he just said, how it operates as a facet of normality, not as a pathology and not as a disease. And to have done one of these things would have been enough and enriching. To have done both is really quite remarkable. So thank you very much indeed for a provocative evening full of insight and delivered with immense clarity. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you all. And the meeting will now end very speedily. Thank you.